It's Tuesday, December 10, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. We'll add one more country to those offering legal same-sex marriage, at least for now. That country is Australia. Last Saturday, the first same-sex marriages, legal same-sex marriages in Australia took place in the Capital Territory, in the very town of Canberra. And what took place there is going to be challenged by the national government. The new Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, is challenging legal same-sex marriage in Australia in the courts, but the first court hearing can't be held until December the 12th. That means that from Saturday, at least until then, some same-sex marriages are going to take place. Those marriages did take place in what the Wall Street Journal's Rob Taylor called a rainbow weekend of unions that took the equal rights issue on marriage right to the national capital of that nation. The situation in Australia is somewhat different than that here in the United States. In the United States, by constitutional and legal tradition, the states define marriage. But in Australia, only the national government defines marriage. That's why having this one territory move towards legal same-sex marriage is now representing a constitutional crisis for that entire nation. But here's the bottom line. Those who have been campaigning and pushing hard for the legalization of same-sex marriage in Australia now have, in at least one territory, at least for a few days, what amounts to legal same-sex marriage. Thus, they have presented a challenge to the nation not to do something the nation hasn't done before, but to overturn an action that has just been taken and is now gaining ground in the Capital Territory. There is a constitutional challenge to any law in Australia prohibiting same-sex marriage, but Australia has been behind other nations in the region, most particularly New Zealand. In April of this year, that neighboring nation legalized same-sex marriage. And, of course, many other nations such as Canada and Spain have already done the same. Several European nations have legal same-sex marriage, as do 16 states in the United States. But we still need to note something with great care. And that is that just a matter of a few years ago, certainly just 20 years ago, not one country on the planet had legal same-sex marriage. And in terms of the situation today, the vast majority of the peoples of the earth have no access to legal same-sex marriage. The people inhabiting most of the nations of this world know what marriage is as the union of a man and a woman, and thus the issue of same-sex marriage, which seems to be gaining so much momentum in terms of Western cultures, doesn't appear to be making much headway at all in terms of many of the other cultures of the world. But count Australia now as a key battleground on the issue of same-sex marriage. By the way, the first same-sex marriage ceremony that took place was overseen by a minister representing the Uniting Church. That's a rather liberal assemblage of several different denominations uniting in one church there in Australia. It was the Reverend Roger Munson who was officiating at that first same-sex marriage. And as he said, quote, "I wanted to offer an alternative to people from any faith tradition, not just Christianity," end quote. Well, here's something to think about. When you have anyone refer to Christianity as a faith tradition, you already have a problem. What we're looking at here is a pattern that's very easily understandable. You have a liberal minister in a rather liberal denomination that is doing what Scripture forbids and doing so with the applause of the world. When you reduce Christianity to a faith tradition, then you can change the tradition. It's a truth statement, not merely a faith tradition. This kind of language betrays the very worldview that allows a minister to preside at a same-sex marriage ceremony. Shifting back to the United States, there is controversy aplenty over the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. The early controversy had to do with the fact that it was passed without a single Republican vote, hardly a bipartisan effort. The controversy then came to the fact that it was going to be a restructuring of at least one-sixth of the American economy. After that, the controversy was, of course, the very awkward rollout, a disastrous rollout in technological terms, and the political problems that have been swirling around it subsequently. But now new problems are emerging, and it goes back to a basic issue we need to keep in mind. If you try to tamper with one-sixth of the American economy in terms of one piece of legislation, if you try to accomplish something this massive and to do so in one comprehensive bill without bipartisan support, you're going to run into some major complications. And the other thing that we need to watch here very carefully is the difference between how this piece of legislation was sold and how it is actually going to take place. For instance, one of the controversies over Obamacare is whether or not the average middle-class family is going to come out ahead. Now, simple common sense says it's almost impossible for that to take place since it's the middle class that has to pay for this new benefit. But the Wall Street Journal was out yesterday with a very important front-page story indicating that perhaps the newest controversy is going to be cost-shifting. The controversy over the contraception mandate is one thing, an ongoing concern of tremendous importance, but the controversy over cost-shifting is likely to get the attention of many middle-class Americans. Here's why. As it turns out, that on these new exchanges and under the regimen of Obamacare, many middle-class families in certain states will have a lower insurance premium. But what the Wall Street Journal has demonstrated is that that's going to be offset by a far higher set of deductibles. As a matter of fact, the Journal is estimating that those deductibles may now be 42% higher, which means there will actually be a far higher cost to health care for the families who are so affected. This is then added on to the controversy that President Obama reaped after he had said so many times, if you like your health care insurance, you can keep it, when it turned out that many Americans could not and that the White House knew it at the time. Now you have a situation in which you're going to have a war of the statistics over the cost of Obamacare. But the people who won't be looking at this as such a controversy in terms of whether it's true or not will be those who are paying the bills and those who face the fact that they're going to have a 42% average increase in terms of the deductibles. They're going to immediately find out that the cost for their family is considerably higher. Now, this gets to a very interesting conversation that took place at the New Yorker magazine over the weekend. In one of their programs, they had two guests, George Packer and John Cassidy. And the issue was how the Affordable Care Act is actually going to work and how it's going to impact the economy. The New Yorker is a classic periodical of the American left. The assumption of the New Yorker and largely of its reading audience is going to be in favor of the Obama administration, in favor of the health care legislation, in favor, in fact, of something that would have gone beyond where the Affordable Care Act actually goes. And so you had these two figures, very knowledgeable about the American economy, both of them often cited, talking about what the bottom line of Obamacare is actually going to be. John Cassidy said, "The biggest thing which Obama has done is to reduce inequality if all goes through and works properly." He said, "It's not just a health care initiative, it's also a big redistributionary initiative," end quote. In other words, he's talking here in open, in candor, about what Obamacare actually will end up being. A massive wealth redistribution program, as he said, if it works according to plan. So when you think about how a major piece of legislation is sold to the American people, justified by elected politicians, beginning with the president, you do not have what you have explicitly in this acknowledgement, that the big issue is the redistribution of income from one class of Americans to another. But that's simple math. Once again, if you ask the question, who's going to pay for this? It's going to be the middle class. Can the middle class pay for a very expensive expansion of health care without paying more in terms of taxes? Well, the answer is no. Not unless you rebrand those taxes as something else, such as far higher deductibles in an insurance policy. Here's something that virtually every American knows, or every individual, regardless of citizenship, who understands math. If something costs more, you've got to pay more. And eventually, the people doing the paying are the people who are actually paying the taxes. In other words, the great middle class in the United States. There is no other source of massive wealth or financial energy in the United States than the middle class. Of course, the problem with this kind of government expansion is that the middle class ceases to expand. And the problem with this specific legislation is that the average middle class family may find out that they are economically reduced rather than enhanced by this new policy. In recent days, the New York Times has given considerable attention to the PISA test, that's PISA, the international test given to millions of 15-year-olds in order to understand their educational and learning attainments. Here's the good news for the United States, we're doing slightly better in reading. Here's the bad news, we're losing ground further in math and science. As Thomas Friedman writes, a columnist for the New York Times, the latest results in the Program for International Student Assessment, or PISA, which compare how well 15-year-olds in 65 cities and countries can apply math, science, and reading skills to solve real-world problems, was released last week. And it wasn't pretty for the home team. As Andreas Schleicher, who manages PISA for the U.S. Department of Education, said, 3 years ago, I came here with a special report benchmarking the U.S. against some of the best-performing and rapidly improving education systems. Most of them have pulled further ahead. According to this latest test and the New York Times reports, the math results of the top performer Shanghai are now 2.5 school years ahead, even of those in Massachusetts, which is the leader among states in the United States. Thomas Friedman responds with two words in his verdict, not good. He continued to say, we are now in an era in which globalization and the information technology revolution have merged to drastically shrink what was the basis of our middle class for so many years, the high-wage, middle-skilled job. In a less integrated and less automated world of walls where unions held more sway, Friedman writes, many Americans could live in an average middle-class lifestyle with average skills. In today's hyper-connected world, a world without walls, when more Indians, Chinese computers, robots, and software can perform more average blue-collar and white-collar jobs, the only high-wage jobs are increasingly high-skilled jobs. In other words, Friedman argues, the kind of jobs that will require the kind of education in engineering, science, and mathematics, and technology that American 15-year-olds seem to be falling behind some in other lands in terms of learning and educationally performing. But it's not just Thomas Friedman, the columnist for the New York Times, that has this concern. It's the entire editorial board of that leading newspaper. The New York Times editorial board on Sunday released a massive editorial, far larger than usual, representing the verdict of the entire editorial board. And in this editorial, they offered four steps the United States could make to get further ahead, or at least not to fall further behind. Those four are a more flexible curriculum. Second, very early exposure to numbers. Third, better teacher preparation. And fourth, experience in the real world. Well, let's say that all four of those are basically non-controversial, at least as they are written here. The first, a more flexible curriculum. Well, it turns out that Americans probably need to be giving more attention to those students who have an inadequate background in math and science, and that will require greater flexibility. Of course, the Common Core curriculum, now adopted by the federal government, may make that less rather than more possible. The second thing was early exposure. In fact, they say very early exposure to numbers. They write only 18% of American adults can calculate how much a carpet will cost if they know the size of the room and the per yard price of the carpet. 1 in 5 American adults lack the basic math skills expected of 8th graders, which probably underlines the problem. In other words, an early exposure to math and numbers would probably, indeed, almost surely be advantageous. The third thing they suggested was better teacher preparation. This goes back to the analysis offered by so many that one of the areas where the United States falls flat is in terms of training and teaching teachers. Teachers' colleges are some of the weakest colleges in America, and virtually everyone knows that. And the fourth was experience in the real world. A growing number, they say, of schools are helping students embrace classes in engineering, science, technology, and mathematics by linking them to potential employers and careers, taking math and science out of the textbooks and into their lives. Again, who could argue with that? What's the problem with this editorial? It's not what's here. It's what's missing. In order to understand that, all you have to know about is Amanda Ripley and her research in terms of her book, The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. I did a Thinking in Public conversation with Amanda Ripley, and a point she makes in her book and in that conversation is what's missing in this editorial. Parents. It turns out, as she said, that the greatest influence in how these students actually turn out is parental involvement. She's very specific about that. She says when it comes to learning, the most important thing a child can have is parents in the home who actually demonstrate a love of learning, a love of reading, a love of math. In other words, parents are essential to this picture. And as we argue over and over again, if you take parents out of the picture, no government program, no school, no curriculum can solve the problem. To give Thomas Friedman credit, he uses the word parents once. This is what he says. The PISA research shows that students whose parents have high expectations for them tend to have more perseverance, greater intrinsic motivation to learn, end quote. Well, go figure. What he says is just straightforward. Those students who have parents who expect them to do well do better than those who lack those parents. Let's just say this. If you needed Tom Friedman to make that argument for you, you're probably a part of the problem rather than the solution. But it's very interesting that in this massive editorial by the well-intended editorial board of the New York Times, what's missing is the one thing that's most important, and that is engaged, involved parents. Where those parents are absent, where they are not involved, where they're not engaged, you can expect these test scores to go lower and lower, no matter what you do with the rest of the society. North Korea was back in the news in recent days. First, it was back in the news because it was holding captive Merrill Newman, an 85-year-old veteran of the Korean conflict who had gone back, an American citizen, as a tourist in North Korea. That's where the story gets really interesting and, frankly, somewhat odd. As the New York Times reports about Merrill Newman, quote, the Korean War still echoed within him. In early 1953, he served on the island of Chodo, advising North Korean anti-communist guerrillas in raids in the mainland. Those fighters crossed the Yellow Sea in leaky old junks. They ambushed supply trucks. They stole weapons. They rescued refugees and attacked enemy soldiers and local communist leaders. End quote. As it turns out, Mr. Newman tried to make contact with some family members of those who had served with him in this effort against the communists in North Korea. Go figure. In other words, this was something of a suicide mission, at least in political terms. Here you had a man going to the Hermit Kingdom of North Korea, going in trying to make contact with the enemies of North Korea, something that was not only, as it turns out, dangerous to him, but could have been deadly dangerous to those he was trying to contact. He was taken captive, and eventually he had to go before the world and make one of those humiliating admissions and confessions that the North Koreans have required of so many to make. And by the way, everyone knew the North Koreans wrote it because the English is so poor. It was the demonstration of the fact that the North Koreans had written the script that the elderly man had to read. He was released. The North Korean word was deported over the weekend and is finding his way back to the United States. We can celebrate the fact he was released, but this is another reminder of what the United States State Department has been saying all along. Americans should not be tourists in North Korea. You're talking about a murderous nation. You're talking about one of those evil regimes ever to mark human history. And you're talking about an inscrutable leadership with an inscrutably evil design, doing whatever it wants, using whatever repressive methods. We were talking in recent days about the mass execution of some people in North Korea in recent weeks, merely for watching a Western movie or for, you'll remember, owning a Bible. But our consideration of North Korea is incomplete without considering who disappeared in North Korea over the same weekend. It wasn't the American, it was a North Korean leader. In this case, it was the number two leader in the regime. His name is Jang Song-taek. He is the uncle of the current strongman there in North Korea, Kim Jong-un. He was the man who, as Kim Jong-un took office, was assigned to be his protector, his advisor, his co-regent, and now he is out. And boy, is he out. He's out as only you can be out in a communist regime. Back during the age of the Soviet Union, you could tell who was in and out because of photographs, in successive editions, for instance, of the new Soviet encyclopedia. Every time that encyclopedia came out in successive years, you immediately learned to turn to the photographs, because the photographs would airbrush out whoever wasn't in political favor when that edition of the encyclopedia was released. You could take several successive editions of the encyclopedia, put them side by side, looking at the same photograph, and people would appear and disappear, airbrushed in, airbrushed out of the photographs. The Soviets did it, by the way, so crudely that sometimes there would be multiple people shaking hands, and there'd be more hands than would add up from the number of people. The same thing is apparently happening in North Korea. Perhaps new technology lets it happen faster. But North Korea has done the unusual thing over the last couple of days of announcing that he has officially been stripped of his party identity. He has been indicted for crimes and he has simply disappeared. He did not appear in a recent public event there in North Korea. And as many North Korean watchers have indicated, no one has ever been seen again after disappearing in this way in North Korea. It turns out that it's very dangerous to be a Christian in North Korea. It turns out it's very dangerous to be an American tourist in North Korea. And it turns out it's very, very dangerous to be the uncle of the dear leader in North Korea. Finally, while we're thinking about education in America, the most illustrious name in American higher education, the oldest of the universities serving the United States, is none other than Harvard University. You would think that at least academic quality would be affirmed and honored and protected there. But the Atlantic Magazine is reporting that the most commonly awarded grade at Harvard is an A. Indeed, the median grade, that is the average grade at Harvard College, is an A-. The report coming from the school's dean of education said the median grade at Harvard is an A-. The most frequently awarded grade at Harvard College is actually a straight A. It makes you think about Garrison Keillor and his fictional Lake Wobegon, the town he talks about in terms of the Prairie Home Companion. You'll recall that there, all the children are above average. If that defies math, it simply reflects what evidently is the curve at Harvard University, where the students there are all far above average, even above their own average, where the average grade is an A. Well, everyone knows you have to be smart to get in at Harvard, but does every student in every class at Harvard get an A? That's a new thing. As the former Harvard president Larry Sumner said, 90% of Harvard graduates graduate with honors. As he said, the most unique honor you could graduate with was none. It's almost impossible to get there. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.